Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed rec room with the tabletop hockey, the lava lamp and the wood paneling, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight this morning we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Today marks the first anniversary of the death of legendary broadcaster and creator of Coast to Coast AM, Art Bell. Art died April 13th, 2018 at his home in Pahrumph, Nevada. The New York Times referred to Art as an apostle of the paranormal. But for me, he was simply an unbelievably good broadcaster. And like millions of others, I sat up in my bed countless nights into the early morning listening to his enchanting disembodied voice coming into my home by way of the Mojave Desert. When Art passed, the announcement on his website read, "Art had a fascination with the afterlife, and it's heartwarming to know he peacefully slipped into the next world and now knows the answers he sought for so long." So this one's for Art, and I'd like to think he'd be interested in hearing my conversation in hours one and two of this transmission with Susan B. Martinez, PhD, as we delve into her new book, A Field Guide to the Spirit World, The Science of Angel Power, Discarnate Entities, and Demonic Possession. And this book not only documents the life of wandering spirits and their impact on vulnerable human targets, Susan offers up a radical departure from the standard psychological explanations for a host of pathological behaviors, including multiple personality disorder, autism, epilepsy, even migraines, and obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, anxiety, which she all blames on spirit attachment or spirit possession. So this book and conversation are both likely to stir up quite a hornet's nest of controversy with the psychology community. In the summer of 1972, the small town of Louisiana, Missouri, was terrorized by a creature which would eventually be named Momo. But for a few short weeks, there was nothing cute, cuddly, or friendly about this menacing, faceless, hairy creature and its blood-curdling calls. There were even waves of vigilante monster hunters descending on the town. Legend hunter Lyle Blackburn is with us in the second half of the program. He'll be here to try and unravel the truth behind one of the great monster tales to ever rise from the hills and hollers of the American Midwest. A Field Guide to the Spirit World and the Strange Case of Momo the Missouri Monster. We are not coming to you from the high desert, but I hope Mr. Bell would approve, wherever he is. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Susan B. Martinez, PhD, is a writer, linguist, teacher, paranormal researcher with a doctorate in anthropology from Columbia University. She's the author of Delusions in Science and Spirituality, Time of the Quickening, The Lost History of the Little People, and The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man. She lives in Clayton, Georgia. Her latest is Field Guide to the Spirit World, The Science of Angel Power, Discarnate Entities, and Demonic Possession. Susan, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Thank you. It's good to be here, finally.
Yes, welcome aboard, and we're glad to have you. I noticed in your book that you don't have a lot of time for people who suggest that spirits have no consciousness. you really kind of take them to task. Why does that get that idea that some spirits don't have consciousness? Why does that get you so aggravated?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well,
can you give me the context?
Sure. Actually, very early on in the book, you talk about how some people sort of dismiss a haunting as some sort of an energy. They kind of talk vaguely in terms of it being an energy, and as if that as if this entity has no consciousness.
Okay. Now I got you. We're talking about intelligence, and energy has no intelligence, and so it's sort of a beating around the bush, or a cop-out, or what have you, to talk about energy or even thought forms. These are all giving us a semantic runaround for what is actually the continuation of life, the continuation of consciousness after dropping the body.
One of the terms that you use to describe a spirit, which I quite like, is an etheric condensation. Could you sort of delve into that a little more? What do you mean exactly by etheric condensation?
It's not my own phrase. I was in the book, I was collecting other people's descriptions of spiritual realities, but I did latch onto that one, etheric condensation, because we are actually talking about what's in the ethers. We are actually talking about our own existence once we're no longer attached to a body, and that insubstantial substance, if you'll forgive that phrasing, is what the ether is. It's the reality beyond the corporeal reality, which is all that we know here living in matter. But it's the answer to matter. It's non-matter.
Right.
And that is where our existence takes place after we're no longer in corpore.
You have a doctorate in anthropology from a very esteemed institution, Columbia University, no less. I'm wondering how you moved from anthropology into this field of the paranormal.
Well, you know, doesn't everybody have shifting interests in the course of their lifetime? I was kind of a language freak. That's how I ended up a writer, I guess. But I specialized in linguistic anthropology, and it kind of narrowed my interest down to the field of languages. I ended up writing a grammar of a South American Indian language. So how do you go from one thing to the other? We all have multiple interests. I would say that in my 30s, I got interested in finding out what life was really about and what I should be doing. And I latched onto the idea that what I needed, what a person needs to do in life was become a better person. Not too complex, but that was it. And so I think my journey got serious at that point. And then late in my 30s, I got a hold of the OASPE Bible, which kind of enlightened me in the areas I was questing. And
what is the OASPE Bible, Susan? Forgive my ignorance, but what is the OASPE Bible?
Well, you don't have to ask for forgiveness because most people have never heard of it, but it is a new Bible. It's a modern Bible. It came into the world in the early 1880s. It was channeled by a dentist in New York on the earliest model of the Remington typewriter. That was in 1881. It was the first and most extensive case of automatic typewriting. Okay, and the result was a new Bible. It was named OASPE. I will break that down for you, and it'll help you understand what's different about this Bible. The O stands for the sky world. The A is the Native American word for earth. And spe is the ancient word for spirit. So it combines earth, sky, and spirit, and it gives a great deal of information on each of those dwelling places of man.
And after reading the OASPE Bible, would it be accurate to say that you became a believer in the spirit world, where perhaps prior you were not?
That's quite true, Richard.
I'm wondering, because when I think of, you know, the halls of academia, and this may not be accurate, but it is my perception, that they are populated primarily by materialists. And here you are, a doctor in anthropology from Columbia, writing a book called The Field Guide to the Spirit World. How does this go over with your colleagues, I'm wondering?
Well, I did depart from academia, and I've been a freelancer ever since.
All right. So not a lot of interaction with your former colleagues then.
No. I got my colleagues at this time are mostly spiritualists like myself.
Right. But when we're talking about the skeptics in this area, in this space, we're talking primarily about materialists who don't believe in the existence of an afterlife. But how do you convince or discuss with a materialist who is looking for physical evidence for a non-physical entity? How do you tackle that?
Well, you know, that's what we're doing here, I guess, because the situation is this. Spiritualists are not fond of conversations with materialists, particularly not fond of being put in a position to convince them one way or the other of their beliefs. You know, everyone has their beliefs and is entitled to them. For the spiritualist, it goes without saying that we are more than just our bodies. It's understood. If we're given a challenge to confront a skeptic and say convincing things, it's really a little uncomfortable. But since I have written the book, I'm committed to addressing that very problem. And that's what I do in the book. And I can also do it verbally by saying, there is a great deal of evidence. It's just a matter of what we have decided to look at and take seriously. The fact is that the American culture and Western Europe, Western culture, is in the minority as against all the third world societies and historical societies, which have all along been believers in what lies beyond.
You write in the back of the book, we are spirits housed in a body, and just as houses can be haunted, so can people. When the living succumb to disassociative states of consciousness, they become a magnet for lost but clinging spirits. So why do the spirits choose one individual over another to attach themselves to?
There is a phrase like unto like. And this applies as much in the world we live in as it does in the next world. So that to the spiritualists, it's a matter of fact that the musician in this life is inspired, overshadowed by the spiritual musician. The mathematician in this life is overshadowed and inspired by the mathematician in spirit. So you have that principle working across and beyond the veil.
But not everyone is being oppressed or possessed by a spirit, so there must be something more. I mean, you talk about a vulnerable person being targeted by a spirit. What do you mean by vulnerable?
Well, here's where we have the entire spectrum of human types, personality types, and we want to consider the whole spectrum because everybody is influenced by spirit, not just the artistic genius and not just the total abnormal freak. Everyone in between as well has spiritual overshadowing. It's just something we're not terribly aware of.
Now, here's where things get quite controversial, and I'm sure this is going to prick up the ears of many psychologists, and that is that you're strongly suggesting in this book, or emphasizing, that a lot of pathological behaviors, including multiple personality disorder, autism, epilepsy, migraines, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, anxiety, self-destructive urges, other strange outbursts, are the result of what you call true impressions of spirit input. Now, how is that going over with psychologists, do you suppose?
I think that psychologists, among them are many who have a sense that the spirit world does have a significant influence, particularly after reading great writers like M. Scott Peck and psychiatrists like Edith Fiore. They made a mark. They are among a small minority. There was also Dr. Ellison and a few others. A Crabtree, a handful of psychiatrists who have recognized the otherworldly component in that which influences our behavior, and they have used it in therapy to cure their patients. They have conducted exorcisms, so it's already happening, but it's a very tiny minority. Now, I'm trying to remember your question, and I got carried away and forgot what.
No, not at all. You acquitted yourself quite nicely. You mentioned a handful of psychologists, psychiatrists, who might concur with your findings, but I'm guessing the vast majority would say, and I'm just going to, you know, obviously put words in their mouth, this is an outrage, Susan. How can you suggest, for example, that obsessive compulsive disorder or autism is caused by spirit attachment? That's absolutely ludicrous. I'm hearing them saying such a thing.
Oh, well, they should look at the data instead of what they're the pressure that's coming from their colleagues. I want to back up for a second and say that I deal with this in all my writings. I have to deal with it. And the shorthand, words that I use is SCIMAT, which stands for Scientific Materialism. So that's where these people are coming from. And they're, in order to be accepted in the university and among the sciences, they have to render tangible evidence. But that's absurd because we're dealing with an intangible area of life.
All right, Susan, I've got to take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue to delve into the spirit world. Susan B. Martinez, PhD, my guest. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y because I love you, R-E-double-T. We'll get back to more of my conversation with Susan B. Martinez, the author of Field Guide to the Spirit World. Hey, check out the highlight carousel up at Coast to Coast AM, where George Norrie has just provided this amazing photograph of what appears to be the shadow of a classic alien gray, which George reports appeared on the wall of his office this very afternoon at 4 p.m. Again, that's the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Susan B. Martinez is a writer, linguist, teacher, and paranormal researcher, the author of the Field Guide to the Spirit World. And one of the things that you point out in the book is that there are many commonalities when we're talking about certain pathological behaviors, whether it's multiple personality disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, other sort of strange outbursts and so forth. Can you sort of walk us through these commonalities and why it's important?
Well, as I was going through the research and the writing, it was obvious that I was talking about human behavior, normal and abnormal, and there's so much. You go into these different behaviors, and especially in the abnormal area, and there's so much overlap between them, and there's got to be an explanation, an underlying principle that makes so many of the symptoms shared between all the different kinds of mental disorders. And so I found that there is an underlying principle, and it's a psychic one. In fact, the field of psychology names itself after the Greek word psyche, which means soul. You know, it means,
which is rather ironic, because I would say probably the majority of psychologists would deny the existence of the soul. I might be wrong, but
you're not wrong, and that's exactly my point. So that's a starting point right there. There's the commonality, the underlying principle is the soul and the wanderings of the soul. Since we have become committed to scientific materialism, we have cast out that whole aspect of things and therefore missed out on what's really going on. All we've got in the field of therapy or psychiatry or a bunch of labels, and they will admit it themselves. They will admit their ignorance themselves, and they just kind of throw their hands up in the air. But getting back to an actual answer to your question, the one thing that seems to come up in almost all the weird cases that we're dealing with is early trauma. So that means that whether we're talking about the multiple or the obsessed or the compulsive disorder or autism or artistic, even the artistic areas of genius, all across the board, we find that there is an open psyche there that is receiving impulses or information or impressions from elsewhere, and how did the psyche get opened? That happens in the case of trauma, which most prominently is head trauma in early life, but it could be any number of a panic, terror, shock, fever, serious illness, near-death experience. I mean, there's a whole range of calamities in which we will say that the psyche looks for an out because it can't stand the pain. We're also talking about pain. So the spirit runs away. It runs away from the body, and that leaves it vulnerable to the entrance of wandering spirits. I took notes earlier when we were talking, and you had asked about vulnerable, and I got carried away with something else and didn't answer it. But here comes the answer. That is what makes people vulnerable, is having psyche opened in that manner.
So there's a vacuum that's created, a moment, even if it's fleeting, and that leaves the living person open to a spirit attachment. These spirits are wandering around looking for someone to glom onto, and they're very opportunistic, I'm guessing, and they wait for someone to have some sort of a traumatic event when their psyche sort of attempts to sort of to flee. It's the fight or flee instinct, I guess. They rush in. Is that the idea?
Oh, yeah. And it's not a new idea, Richard. It's been around forever. But we're becoming reacquainted with it now because our material systems are failing us. And so many people are retracing their steps and looking for what is real and what spiritualism really is.
Now, just so that I'm clear and that our listeners are clear, are you saying that in all of these cases, it's always a spirit attachment? Or, I mean, do you believe that it's possible, let's say for someone who has autism, and obviously this is like near epidemic proportions now, this is a huge, huge issue, that it's always spirit attachment and never some sort of underlying organic brain disease?
Well, that's a subject that comes up all the time. People seem desperate to find to pin it on something tangible. And yes, of course, there are manifestations, a physical manifestation. Now let's take the brain waves of a schizophrenic, for example. What I want to say is that let me see if I can say this right. If you find a person has unusual behavior, and you find that their brain waves are unusual, the CIMAT model interprets this by saying the odd brain waves is causing the schizophrenic behavior. Okay, that's what the CIMAT model.
The scientific materialists, right.
But I'm saying that the spiritual condition of that person could be causing the brain waves to be going crazy. You know, it could be going the other way than the way we have interpreted it.
So the auditory hallucinations that someone is experiencing, are they actually then hearing the voice of the spirit that has attached themselves to that person?
Oh, yes. Ask any multiple personality disorder victim, and they will tell you about the voices. We find also in serious criminal cases, there's also a voice that commanded them to do the crime. So this is really very common and has been almost entirely suppressed in the literature by calling it hallucination and brushing it off.
So if someone has multiple personality disorder, and I'm not sure, did they now call that dissociative disorder?
Yeah.
Where they're, the other personality that's coming to the fore.
It's called an alter.
An alter. Is that the personality of the oppressing spirit that's coming to the fore?
Absolutely. And what psychiatry calls it is part of their own unconscious. They're called inner selves. And supposedly they are part of yourself and have nothing to do with the spirit world. But the victim herself will tell you that it's not part of herself. It's something out there that's attacking them. There really is a tremendous amount of information in this respect, but it has not been taken under consideration.
We think of high-profile multiple personality disorder patients or victims, if you will, like Eve or Sybil. I mean, again, the word multiple. So multiple spirits have attached themselves to these poor people?
That's right. Sometimes it has been known to run into hundreds and even thousands of spirits that can infest a single person. The highest number I came across was a victim of a satanic abuse, and there's a book about her. Her name was Jenny, and she had 400 alters.
My word, 400. Now, you mentioned something earlier that we have to circle back and discuss, and that is criminal behavior, in particular, serial killers. So you mentioned earlier that like attracts like. So if we have someone who is, let's say, John Wayne Gacy, horrible, horrible human being, killing young men, young teenagers, and are you suggesting that John Wayne Gacy was himself the victim of a spirit attachment, the spirit of a monstrous killer?
Oh, absolutely. And all you have to do is dip into the case history to pull out all the significant red flags. In the book, I make a point of listing symptoms, behaviors to look out for, and that constitute red flag for spiritual obsession, for negative overshadowing. John Wayne Gacy, okay, it started with trauma, and it was head trauma, which is the most severe. A difficult mother. He had accidents in childhood. He heard the voice. The one difference with Gacy was that he was in total denial. He denied the killings. So in a way, he's not a perfect example. But there are others in that list of killers and serial killers who will talk openly about the voices they heard, about being told by the voice that if they didn't go out and kill, they were nobody. And on and on. Really, there's such a rich field. I wrote a book about, which is not published, which I'd like to be published, about school shooting. about school shooters in this country in the last 30 years, and the same lineup comes out in that work, where these boys, almost all of them, have heard the voice, and they will talk about it. They'll tell you what the voice said to them. And so it's nothing new. It's just that we're not familiar with it because we're not taught from the start that we are spirits in a body.
But Susan, here's the nub of the matter, and that is, what does this sense say about personal responsibility?
Okay. That is particularly when you're in the talking about crime, that's the problem, because in order to litigate against these dangerous people who have alternate personalities and particularly violent ones, in order to litigate, our legal system is set up in such a way that you have to prove that he's bad, not mad. Do you get what I'm saying?
You have,
in other words, if the defendant is insane, he can't be adjudicated. Our legal requirements make it impossible to recognize the otherworldly component here, because it appears to get him off the hook, but it doesn't. It doesn't, and anyone who is that dangerous has to be taken out of circulation. So we need a whole revamping of the legal aspect to this. They have had to shove aside the demonic possession because it's totally unacceptable in the scientific field and in the legal field. So we are so far from the truth that it is pathetic.
Now, you mentioned, again, like attracts like. So does that mean that serial killers, people who go on to kill, are themselves being possessed by other serial killers? And if they are attracted to humans,
yes,
that are...
I think if you did make a study of this and zeroed in on it, I think you would find that to be a fact. I will tell you that my theory of schizophrenia is, no one has agreed with me so far, but I think it would prove out if we had a way of studying it. My theory of schizophrenia is that these people, I'm talking about far gone cases, these people are overshadowed by insane spirits.
Right. Right.
You see, the total opposite of that is genius, creative genius, which is overshadowed by those who are geniuses who have passed on and are in the spirit world and continue to look to inspire a protege.
Right.
That's
but I just, if I could.
Category.
We're coming up to the top of the hour, and we're going to break here in a moment, but and maybe we can discuss this after.
Okay.
That if like attracts like, it would stand to reason then that a serial killer is going to be he's a bad seed to begin with in order to attract a spirit that was bad. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But now when I studied the kids in the school shooting book, they were just vulnerable kids. They weren't evil, but they were too open to spirit, and there was too much negative stuff in the early household. The ego never developed properly, and that they were vulnerable, and they were attacked by actually evil spirits.
Those All right, Susan, we'll take another time out here, and we'll also open up the phone lines, questions and comments for Susan Martinez.